welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And in our appeals to heaven, we need to continue Learn, Pray, Act. And we're trying to provide you a bevy, a cornucopia of documents in every form, source documents that we will actually have for you to enjoy understanding how the framers defined the Constitution. Now, let's be clear. It's all about full compliance. Folks, I see legislators. I see legislators in Republican red counties that are dancing around and avoiding their responsibility to support the Constitution. As a matter of fact, in Stevens County, they're actually getting lawyers to give them the language of how they cannot support the Constitution. In other words, the two questionable commissioners, Stobert and Young, they need to go. They're abjugating their responsibility so that they won't have to support the Constitution, because the powers that be do not want that to happen. We don't want to hold this tyrant Ferguson in Washington State accountable. We want them to keep doing what they're doing up in the courts and everything else. So with that, it's all about demanding full compliance of every single person who's under oath. And more importantly, getting our representatives, our legislators, to do their job. Okay, so welcome back, Sean. And so what I wanted to do is kind of bring up what I didn't do yesterday, and that's actually diving into Monroe's veto statement. Because I said I was going to get it, and then when we came back, I was, you know, already in elbows deep in another topic, and I totally forgot. And so the thing about Monroe's veto statement, and it's so powerful because, folks, there are three vetoes of the Department of Transportation. The first one was with Madison. And when you read Madison's, most people have a hard time understanding what Madison stated. One of the things that, so there's real big benefits in reading all three because they all attack the problem in a different way. I think Monroe's is the most simplest for people to understand. And it completely aligns with the whole theme, or I should say, the way the Constitution was justified in the ratification process, that if it's not delegated, they can't meddle with it. And here three presidents basically held Congress accountable to say, hey, that's not delegated, you can't meddle with it. So Madison, when he vetoed it in 1817, we're going to dive into these documents later, but when he vetoed, he actually pointed out the clauses that were typically the culprits. Even by the Anti-Federalists, they pointed out these same clauses in the debates, in the ratification debates, to say, we think these are problems. But what Madison did was he basically says, hey, the Commerce Clause, this General Defense and Welfare Clause, the Supremacy Clause, and the Necessary and Proper Clause, those four clauses are not portals to obtain a new enumeration. You must amend the Constitution if it is not enumerated. They grant no special powers, those four clauses. So Madison was seeing at that point in time the way the courts were and the way, you know, lawyers and the lawyers speak and everything else was starting to twist towards perverting or basically building off of the Anti-Federalists to say, hey, these arguments could be used as weapons, or I should say these clauses. So he wanted to make sure he shut that down. But the one thing that Madison states, and we'll get into this when we read these, once we're done with the Constitution. Madison basically said, it doesn't matter even if the states allow you to do this unconstitutionally. At any point in time, they can basically wake up and stop you because it is not constitutional. Just because they let you do it doesn't mean that that is constitutional and it will always be a violation. So, in Monroe's statement, this is what I wanted to share with you. You know, Monroe kind of goes down this path, and in paragraph 5, he actually lists what Congress was justifying in the bill for the reasons why they needed to start taxing and building and improving highways, waterways, and so forth. And he said, first, because actually I'll read the leading paragraph. He says, it has never been contended that the power was specifically granted. They're basically saying that it's kind of implied by these other powers, right? And he says, it is claimed only as being incidental to some or one or more of the powers which are specifically granted. The following are the powers from which it is said to be derived. First, from the right to establish post offices and post roads. Second, from the right to declare war. Third, to the regulate commerce. Fourth, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and welfare. Fifth, from the power to make all laws necessary. So right there, the clause necessary and proper was being used. And the common defense and welfare. Those two clauses were just general clauses that didn't grant them new powers and not portals to assume new powers. And then again, and all powers vested by the Constitution in the government of the United States or in the Department of Officers thereof. Sixth and lastly, from the powers to dispose and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory and other property of the United States. Now, that right there is an answer we will get into this. That is out of Article 4, Section 3. That's about admitting states. And so we'll actually dive into this. And so, Sean, just remember, when we get to Article 4, Section 3, if you could just make a little note about Monroe's veto of how they were trying to use that clause in Article 4, Section 3 when it had nothing to do with actual powers delegated. And we'll dive into this, and I'll show you folks how what they were citing were not powers delegated to Congress as a permanent thing. It was an ancillary responsibility in preparing states to become, or territories to become states. So anyway, as Monroe kind of sums this all up, according to my judgment, it cannot be derived from either of those powers, nor from all of them united. And in consequence, it does not exist. And so I don't think he could have put it any more simply. When you read Andrew Jackson cites, literally quotes Madison in his veto statement, and he quotes Monroe. And then he goes on and, you know, it's the longest one because he's including the two previous ones. And then he goes down this path of, you know, hey, I would be happy to enjoy and entertain, you know, getting the states to amend the Constitution. If the good people of America want us to have this power, they'll give it to us. Let's go get that amendment. But instead, Congress, and I believe, you know, so I see the divine hand of providence in so many different ways. And I see what Congress was trying to do. The divine hand of providence was basically documenting this to actually help us understand Congress needed to have a success in assuming powers not granted. And these were direct powers to assume by Congress. Now, we've already covered I've already covered other documents, such as the Enabling Acts, where they actually started assuming powers not granted. And as a matter of fact, in 1820, they were already assuming these powers in the admission of states. And so we'll get into that when we cover Article 4, Section 3, in the role and responsibility of Congress to admit new states into the Union. That is a role and responsibility, not a power. And so, anyway, was there something else? Yeah, actually, there was something else, because we were just going into the what part of the Constitution? Sorry, Article 1, Section 8. Oh, yeah. To define punish piracies, right? and felonies on the high seas. We're just starting to cover this and the offenses against the laws of nations. And so let me read this again so that we know exactly what the power is in Article 1, Section 8. Congress have the power to define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and I kind of pointed out that's a crime. These crimes, these piracies and felonies, are committed out in international water. And the offenses against the law of nations. Well, that's an international law, and the only way you can actually violate international law, because there's no international law within the United States. What is the prevailing and the only law within the United States?
Constitution.
The Constitution and the state constitutions, right? I mean, the federal constitution is applied to all the states, and each state establishes their own laws and their own system, because we kind of covered this in the ratification debates, how they were exposing, because people wanted to know why didn't they have these very specific things that common law demanded. You know, why didn't you preserve and actually ensure that the trial by jury would be preserved in all things? And in many of the states, they said, hey, why is that not in there? Why is common law not in there? And it was brought up, and every time it was brought up, the Federals came back and said, look, every state has employed different forms of common law. Every state has deployed different forms of granting trial by jury and so forth. So the federal government was not designed to inflict a governing system, a legal system upon the states. The federal government was designed to adapt to the way the states operated their own legal system. Now, I know you didn't get that out of the debates because you weren't a part of that, right?
Correct.
Okay, so I think it's paramount or imperative that I give you that information here and now so that you can start seeing why the federal government, when we get into Article 3 and the courts, why they don't have the authority to establish, you know, these centralized and the concept of, you know, unified laws and unified executions of the law and so forth, because each state had a different way. And the federal government was not to impose upon the states. So this goes down the path of really highlighting how Hamilton and his Federalist Papers opened the door to redefine the Constitution in the most nefarious way possible, giving the courts the power to interpret the law, giving the courts the power to basically create a common law for all states. What that flies in the face of what I just said. Creating a common law so that it would be inflicted upon all states. Hold on here. The federal government was to interface with the states according to their laws and their system, not to inflict upon the federal or inflict upon the states how the federal government wants them. As a matter of fact, I said this several times. If the Constitution required states to make adjustments to their form of government and to their form of legal system, it would have given every single state the justification and I think the ammo to say, look, they think that our government is bad and they want to reframe us into a new government, our own government. How dare they? And they would have rejected the Constitution because it would have demanded that the states complied to what these men felt that they needed for a system. Does that make sense? That makes sense, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, in seeing and putting these pieces together, when we go through the ratification debates, because I know you're looking forward to that, when we go through them, it's just going to be eye-opening. You go, oh, my gosh. How is it that we got to this point where now we've got, you know, the elbowing and the iron fist being rammed down our throats from the federal government telling us we must comply? It was never their design and intent. Interesting, right? Interesting. So Hamilton knew what he was doing. And as a matter of fact, I believe that, you know, there have been forces, good and evil, that have been pushing you know, events around the world. And I believe 1776 was one of those, the good and evil spirits, or the, I'll just say, what's the best way, the inspiration that came from good and evil was very busy in 1776. Because the Declaration of Independence arose in 1776, the Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith, the Bible to a free economy, and a free commerce system, a free market, that came out in 1776, and he was a Scottish economist. And then, out of Germany, Adam Weishaupt created the Charter for the Illuminati, where they would seize control over all the governments and churches of the world. And that's because if you seize control over a government, what have you also seized control over? Or let's go the other way. If you've seized control over a church, what have you also seized control of? Because every government throughout Europe were theocracies.
You have the people.
Yes. So what we see is that whether they attacked the church or whether they attacked the government, they were basically attacking both, because they were joined throughout the world. The only nation where it wasn't joined was the federal government in the United States. Each state had, you know, their choice of whether they wanted to be joined as a government and church, which is why 8 of the states at the time of ratification had theocracies. I think there were 5 states that were Anglican, there were a couple that were congregational, and so forth and so on. Actually, I don't think it was 5. Yeah, maybe it was 5, because it was still less than 50% of the states. So, anyway. When we
what was
looked,
the second
yes, go ahead, go
work
ahead.
That you had quoted from 1776?
Uh-huh, go ahead.
The Declaration of Independence and Weishaupt, what was the other?
Oh, Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations. Now, let me ask you this, and it's not a trick question, because most people, when they look at economy and economists and our economy, they completely don't understand. We've been taught that we have a capitalist system, right? So what is a capitalist system? What is a capitalist system? Is a capitalist system a free market? Would you find a capitalist system where capitalism is flourishing in a market space where that's capitalism? Do you believe that that would be a free market?
I'm not sure. I'm not really an economist type, but okay. I would think that the capitalist system has to do with credit and something along those lines.
Well, so capitalist means that, you know, there's, you know, well, if you look at a business, there's the concept of having capital, you know, cash, money, investments, holdings, you know, and those types of things. But a capitalist system is basically the evil of the capitalist system, as we're being taught by progressives, it's about profits over people. Profits over people. Now, they believe that we have a free market system, that profits and corporations are free to basically make profits over people, right?
Right, but that's not what was intended.
Well, so actually, our nation was intended to be a free market. This is why, when we go up to the Commerce Clause, the federal government cannot regulate the commerce of a state within the state. Only the commerce among the states.
Among the states.
Right, to ensure that certain states aren't joining together to take advantage of other states, that all states must, you know, openly and freely trade with each other, and making sure that states can't create taxes and burdens upon other states bringing goods into their state. So when we look at something like cars, when Detroit or Michigan and, let's say, Pennsylvania and a couple of other states are making cars, and they're manufacturing cars, and they're bringing those cars out to every state. Can a state regulate those cars and say, you have to make cars, if you want to sell your cars in this state, you have to make them this way?
Doesn't California do that with their emissions standards?
Absolutely. See, now you've got it. But that is a direct violation of the Commerce Clause. However that state wants to make that product, you can't force them to make it a certain way. What you can do is you can make your own product the way you want it, and then you can compete. But that product can still sell in your state. So in other words, you have to make a superior product that the people of your state would rather buy instead of their product. Does that make sense? So that's
yeah. So how did they get around that with the California standards?
Ah, okay. So we're talking about a free market system. There's another word for the free market. It's called the black market. You know what the black market is?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Black market is a market where there are no government regulations. That's what a true free market. However, every state does have the ability to regulate their own commerce, their own commerce. They cannot regulate commerce coming in from other states. Now, they can regulate corporations operating within their state and the functioning of corporations in their state, like Walmart. I think we may have mentioned that. If Walmart comes into a state, then they can actually regulate and say, you know, you're going to do this if they want to have a minimum wage. But to do anything in regulating commerce, they need to have that power delegated to them in that state constitution. Now, they didn't do that because all of the states wanted to have free markets. And the Constitution, when we get to Article 1, Section 10, we'll find that the Constitution forbids states from creating fees and burdens upon other states other than those things that are reasonable, such as New York, all the products coming into New York, into the port, the harbor, and the wear and tear placed upon the port, and the road system as it traverses through New York to get to Pennsylvania, then they can place a burden like a tax and or a fee on the goods that are traversing, but only those that are reasonable. In other words, they can capture their expenses, but they can't make profit. That makes sense? So in other words, you know, the Constitution really made it so that, you know, a state didn't get hurt because they had to bow over to all of the states. But, you know, they had the ability to, claim damages, goods, or wear and tear, those types of things, because of the flow of commerce coming in and out of their state. Therefore, you know, they weren't being taken advantage of. The whole point of the federal government was to ensure that no state was taking advantage of another or a group of states over others and so forth. They were to play fairly with each other. Now, the design was to have a free market. However, we don't have a free market. You tell me what market today is not regulated by the federal government. If the labor market, just the labor market within all corporations, the government has created regulations regarding labor, not just the product manufacturing, but the people that are being employed to create those products. They're regulating them. How is that a free market? Now you see, if you start actually building upon this premise, we have a mercantile system. That's exactly what Britain had. How did we obtain a mercantile system? Other than the fact that we adopted those principles at the federal level first, where they started regulating states and basically allowing these corporations to take advantage of the states and keep the states from protecting themselves from predatory practices and so forth. Same thing with banks and so forth. And so there was this collusion between the federal government and corporations. This was the beginning of globalism. And they started coming, and we're going into a break here, but they started coming to, this point of actualizing globalism in the late 1800s. And it wasn't until Woodrow Wilson brought forth his concept of a League of Nations that we would unite the world over the common good of people, corporations, and so forth, so that all people Nobody would be left behind. But anyway, we'll be right back after this promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so now we can actually see how our, you know, in every way our federal government has gotten us into operating our businesses, everything, even our churches, in ways that they just don't have the authority to do, but they're controlling everything. And this is why Republic Review, this is why Constitution Compliance, First Amendment petitions, getting county Constitution Compliance committees standing up, and why we need to actually start spreading this around. Because, folks, I get this all the time. And as a matter of fact, have you ever heard of the Patriot Academy?
No, I can't say I have.
Okay, so if I know you, you'll probably, you know, put that in DuckDuckGo or some search engine. So so there's the Patriot Academy, but you probably heard of Hillsdale College.
Yes.
Okay. You've probably heard of the John Birch Society. They have a constitutional education system, right?
I've heard of them.
Yes. Okay, but you've probably never seen. But if you actually go, you can find some of their content. You know, they're how they teach. And you know what's interesting? The common theme that I see is that most of these education systems out there that are teaching people the Constitution, the reason that there's an appeal, like the Patriot Academy or the John Birch Society and so forth, is they create this, you know, feel-good story that this nation is a Christian nation. In other words, they're actually making assertions that there's no evidence of. We weren't actually created as a Christian nation. We were a government that was basically open to all religion that the states wanted to create, as long as those religions, those states, the laws, the republican form of government, these types of things, would not become rebellious to the Constitution. In other words, if the religion was embracing individual liberty and individual sovereignty, then that religion was fine with the Constitution. Now remember that when we talk federal government, that's just people that are supposed to be executing their roles and responsibilities and complying to the supreme law of the land. And staying within the Constitution. Same thing at the state government. Same thing at the county government. So when we look at what our governments are supposed to be doing, and eventually the state governments gave up their theocracies, they wanted to be tolerant towards all good, you know, religions and good people. Did you know that if you weren't a Christian in good standing in your community, you did not have a right to testify or bring a case to court, petition the court for justice? Did you know that?
No, I did not know that.
Okay, so that was a practice that was being done in every state. And again, the federal court system, because they knew that they couldn't control that and what the states were doing, they adopted and recognized, and as a matter of fact, Joseph Story, points out in his commentaries that, you know, the reason they did this is because the atheist had no credit with the court. The infidels had no credit. We couldn't trust them. If they couldn't swear to a higher power to be held accountable at some point in time later on after this life, then we can't trust those people. Which is, I mean, that's what he put in. And Alexis de Tocqueville actually had a case in 1833 where a judge basically kicked the case out because the plaintiff was a atheist. And he basically says, hey, you're not a Christian in good standing. You can't function or you can't be in our court. That was a standard. That was a standard that was practiced throughout the Union. Why is that not taught? Because the fact is, these states, there were many states that were theocracies. And so, it flies in the face of the narrative that we were a godless nation. Technically, the states evolved into a higher enlightenment, a higher form of enlightenment. Because, as Madison points out in the Remonstrance, and we'll cover that next year, the Remonstrance on Religious Assessments, as well as when we look at his essay on property and these other things, we start seeing how the free market of religion is an enlightened society, when we can actually have honest and open discourse on, you know, on the Gospels. You know, there are lots of people out there that are creating these, I'll just say, these churches with, you know, rewriting the Bible and so forth. And let me ask you this. What's your feeling on that?
Well,
yeah,
it's a tough subject. But,
it is. Okay.
I mean, the morality that is Christianity is based upon, I feel, is a requirement for the duties of a citizen in the United States of America. So, like, there's no way that our country would survive under Sharia law.
Okay.
Because it's total anathema to the Constitution itself. So,
I love that word, anathema.
And I was going to ask you about that because I've heard a lot of people discussing it.
Uh-huh.
And from what I've seen from original sources and documents and quotes is that religion was when the founders spoke about religion, the only religion they were speaking of was Christianity. Everything else was considered an abomination or heresy. So
yeah, okay.
It was about denomination. They didn't want to establish a specific denomination,
right?
Like Anglican or Puritan or,
yes,
or Quaker or whatever. But the foundations of Christianity and morality that it's based on, I believe, was a requirement for success of the country.
Okay, so I'm going to use the word enlightenment. Enlightenment is obtaining a higher knowledge and a higher understanding of a better way, better laws, a better form of governing, that type of thing. And so the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, was literally a new form of enlightenment in providing a better way of governing. At the time of the Constitution, there were eight states, you've heard me say this, that there were eight states that were theocracies. Some of them were Anglican, some of them were congregational, and so forth. And I think there were a couple that were non-denominational, but they were still theocracies, where the state used the church to take care of compassionate services. In other words, the states had their own education system that they used the church to operate and manage. They didn't have, that was not a role of government. It was a role of the community, the people, and the church. And so I know that, you know, prior to the Second Awakening, most all the churches that were functioning in America were layman type of churches. In other words, there was no professional clergy, that everybody kind of worked together, and they, you know, they had, you know, maybe some hierarchy of judging, because I know in the Puritan or in New England or Massachusetts, there were points in time where people were charged with heresy because they were teaching an apostate doctrine that did not line up with what they wrote as their doctrine for the state of Massachusetts and their theocracy. And that's how Connecticut was formed, because they kicked somebody out, drove them in that direction. That person founded a church and ended up becoming the state of Connecticut. And same thing with New Hampshire. So, I mean, Massachusetts, because of its intolerance towards wandering faith to the doctrine that they believed, that actually created two states. Because these concepts started wandering, and the concept of the freedom of religion and religious expression became truly paramount, where people literally had to choose. Now, let me just say this, because I say this all the time, and I don't know if it helps, but when you go to church, I've been to different churches, and when you go to church and everybody kind of agrees on the doctrine, but if you ask them to describe and define a particular doctrine, you'll find that some people will agree almost verbatim, and there'll be those others that might have an outlier on one particular doctrine or another. And in other words, you'll actually probably find that everybody that sits in the pews, that goes to that church, has a sentiment that is not 100% agreeing with everybody in that church. In other words, you'll find that everybody has their unique variations of how they interpret, how they live, and how they see the doctrine. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. That's only common. As a matter of fact, it's family. You know, because as a family starts working, they have their own problems, and they're challenged in certain things that the doctrine, you know, actually causes them to think and understand, you know, to maybe to be better, you know, in living the law or living this doctrine, that we need to live this way. And so you'll find that some people may have higher standards, some people water their standards down, but they still go to the same church. Everybody is in a different place and a different relationship with the Lord. Everybody. And the whole point that Madison points out in the Remonstrance on Religion is there's nothing more precious than the individual relationship that a person has with their Savior. And I think everybody can really see that and agree, because that's the epitome of Christianity. Or a person of whom they see as their creator, or whomever. So going back to the ideologies and religions that are subjugative, that they do not support the ability for a person to, you know, to evolve or to even worship anything other than their faith. In other words, they mandate that you must be Islamic or Mohammedan, then there's no ability for that faith to actually exist within the United States for U.S. citizens. When you become a member of that faith, you should be stripped of your citizenship, because the supreme law of the land is the Constitution, not Sharia, not the Hadiths, not the Quran, and it's the same thing. When we look at Christianity and people say we need to have a biblical law, we need to have this theocracy, it's one thing to say we want to do that as a state. But it's another thing to say we're going to inflict this faith upon all states. That right there, because we actually have the Bill of Rights, and the federal government is forbidden from establishing a religion. That was a part of the, you know, the 12 amendments to the Constitution, where only the federal government could not establish a religion. They didn't want them to, you know, establish religions. They didn't want them to establish a common law or a legal system. A lot of things, because the states had their own paradigms. And the federal government was not designed to be the standard. It was to adapt to the needs and the paradigms of the state, the systems of the states. Its job was to adapt, not to mandate and unify everybody under their law. And it's all backwards now. They started mandating, they started making law respecting religion. They actually established a church. That Scopes trial established a church, because when you start establishing a doctrine to be taught, then that is paramount to a church, right? You didn't put a bunch of bricks and mortar together and build a church. You basically started creating a doctrine that became godless and secular, and that's what everybody was going to be taught. Anyway, so I want to make sure I answered your question, that when we really look at the citizenship, actually the Mohammedans were banned out of every state in the Union until either the late 1800s or early 1900s. The first mosque was not created until the 1930s. And obviously, all of these things started happening under the era of progressivism, because they needed to bring enemies to Christianity and to the prevailing thoughts of America.
When you say they, what do you mean?
The progressives who were manipulating and controlling the government of the United States. They knew what they needed to do to actually start tearing us down and bringing and importing enemies to the Constitution, because when you have a Mohammedan, they are not supporting the Constitution. They're an enemy thereof. They don't want you to have the freedom. They don't want you to sell pork in their little community. They don't want you to be, you know, going to your own church. When they have the call to prayer, all people will go and pray. Their doctrine is subjugative. In other words, it is basically enforced upon you. And if you don't, within their doctrine, they'll either kill you or they will basically make a slave out of you. And that's what dimitude, or what they call dimitude, where they come and basically either take your money, you know, you have to pay the fee like a slave for your right to, you know, exist within their government. Anyway, it's a very, it's like communism. Islam is just like communism. But communism is just one that doesn't have a specific faith. It must be godless. But have you ever read the Communist Manifesto?
I have not read it. Okay. Know, but I do know a lot about what's in there.
Okay, so in the Communist Manifesto at the very end, the state controls everything. In other words, they evolved to a point, and this was really Engels more than Marx. Marx didn't like to include it, but it was included, that they would choose who would marry who, and they would take the child. So in other words, we have this principle that, you know, we have these God-given rights, and those God-given rights are basically galvanized and maintained in what we call the nucleus of our society, being the family. And God-fearing people creating families, that God gave us our rights. And so in our creation, he gave us the ability to choose for ourselves. So in communism, they believe that government gives you your rights. Government controls everything. Well, that's the direction that they're taking us. And when they actually determine who gets to marry and, you know, what happens to those children, that's one of the reasons why for decades and decades, a century practically, where children were taken out of the home as soon as the mothering or the nurturing of, you know, breastfeeding, those types of things from the child, you know, from the mother, I mean, the child was taken to, you know, an education, an institution where that child would then be categorized and prepared to basically do what they felt that you had the, I'll just say, the aptitude to function as a doctor or a janitor. You know, they just put you on a path that would go down to something that you could, improve upon, or you could actually, you know, find your niche and become happy as a teacher, janitor, whatever, scientist, whatever. And so this way, the state controlled everything, everything. And they gave you everything and they took everything. That, not much difference between that and Islam, right?
Correct. And communism has become more like a religion to the unaware masses that think that they want to try communism or socialism or some form of those what would you call them, political ideas. And they just have no idea what they're even talking about. They just think it's free stuff and everybody's equal.
Yeah, and so
that's not it at all.
Have you ever read Plato's Republic?
No, I have not.
Okay. So Plato's Republic was the first iteration of communism. And the concept is actually statism. But see, communism, because in ancient Greek, they all did have their own faith and religion. But Plato played around with this perfect world where the state controlled everything. And there were four primary jobs or careers that within the republic that were necessary to ensure that everybody did what they were supposed to do, that they would go along with the game. One of the things that Plato talks about is that those who govern cannot own property, that they will be given, and you know, so they'll live in the castles, what have you, but they don't own that, the people own that. And so it kind of breaks down that you've got the governors that are these great people that have been prepared to lead you, but they cannot own and basically steal from you or what have you. But there are three other roles, and if I remember correctly, one of them is teachers. And the teacher basically are the ones that take the child, nurture them, determine what they would do best, and then, you know, put that child on the pathway to, you know, doing those things. Now, in Plato's Republic, the state would control who married who to make sure that the best athletes and the best brilliant minds would be married together so that they would be, you know, they would build even a better society. Because in their day, they believed that, you know, the more generations of these athletes getting together and marrying, they would become, you know, these phenomenal demigods, right? Of all sorts of, you know, abilities, power, and so forth, physical abilities and that type of thing. Same thing with the mental side. So they were basically, you know, playing around with this idea of forming a perfect race. So the
early eugenics.
Yes. And so the there was another one that was the education. There was the entertainment. And entertainment would basically be required to carry the propaganda, the message, to make sure everybody follows the system. You know, do your part. Do what you're told, what you've been prepared, what you were born to do. And then there was, I believe, news, journalism, that type of thing, that helped everybody see. This was all a bunch of statist manipulation in helping everybody go along with the game, go along with the system. And so it's an interesting read. Yeah, it's an interesting read. It was a utopian society, was what he was writing about. Ever since then, there have been several books that have been written that were, you know, altruistic or utopian type of societies and so forth. And the Communist Manifesto was just another one. In other words, what Marx really wrote wasn't unique. This is why a long, long time ago, I used to go out of my way, instead of saying communists, I called them Platonists, you know, because it was Plato that deserves the credit, because he's the guy that first put the pen to paper and said, hey, here's a statist government ideology concept or what have you. And I go, you know, let's give the guy credit instead of Marx. Anyway, so we're supposed to be talking about the Constitution. And bottom line, on subsection 9, regarding the whole point of these piracies, felonies committed on the high sea, and offenses against the laws of nations, the reason this was included was to ensure that the federal court would protect U.S. citizens. Why? Because the federal court would be viewed as a more powerful, the amalgamation, or the, you know, the inclusion government, the inclusion court of all the states, so that when we started dealing with foreign nations, they would take that government far more, you know, far more seriously than maybe Delaware, the smallest state in the union. That's just Delaware. right? They don't scare us. But hey, this inclusive court of the entire union, that's everybody. So this was a brilliant design of actually ensuring that the people had the best protection and defense against these trumped up charges, because actually, who would be arresting people for piracies and felonies committed on the high seas? Technically, who was doing it at that point in time was Britain. They were seizing our ships and impressing our sailors and taking our goods and so forth. And it's the same thing with offenses against laws and nations. So does this make sense why that was there? Because it took me a long time to get to this, but does that make sense why this was so important?
It does, and especially in dealing with the empires that were in power at that time.
Right.
Like you said, one little state's not going to be able to go up against the Spanish or the British or the French Empire.
Yeah.
You know, and if they were united in dealing with those things, it would be a lot more powerful.
Yes.
And the first thing I think of is, and I mentioned this to you before, the Amistad incident.
Yes.
Was one of the early court cases that dealt with that. And they had Spanish, and I think it was 11 or 12-year-old Isabella was the queen, and she was being petulant and wanted her property back. And if you get the chance to watch the movie, what's his name from Silence of the Lambs is in it?
Anthony Hopkins.
Anthony Hopkins, right, uh-huh. Morgan Freeman,
yeah.
Andrew McConaughey.
Yeah.
Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah.
Before he got real famous.
Well, yeah, and then he became, then he came out of the closet as a flaming liberal. But anyway, so I'm actually planning on watching that. But we got about a minute left. And so this is a perfect time to kind of wrap up, because what we're going to deal with is the Declaration of War and all of that. Because this is where we get into the national defense, because that is really the primary focus of securing and protecting. Now, what we just did was the securing and protecting of the citizens who traveled abroad, you know, whether you were a sailor, what have you. Now, when we look today at the sovereign citizen movement, whatever you want to call these different movements out there, they all say that the 14th Amendment established jurisdiction over U.S. citizens. And I'm telling you right here, no, it's right here. It's right here in the original Constitution that the federal government had jurisdiction in international law to protect the citizens of the United States. That the rest was left to the states, and we'll dive into that with Article 3 as well as the 11th Amendment, but I digress. I really appreciate, we don't usually get a chance to kind of wrap up like this. I appreciate your assistance and you coming on the show and helping, because I don't get a chance to say that enough. But anyway, it's really an honor in having you on. And folks, as I always say, as we dive through this, we're helping you understand the Constitution. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.